accession number 23228, real 9.
Professor Hugh de Wardener, real 9.
Yes, I was saying these NIPs came from other camps. And we knew that they were coming, so we had built a special place at the back for them, sort of fenced in, and a few. And I imagine the NIP sergeant had asked for that. And we had about four or five officers, apart from the medical officers, in the camp, British officers, and we had arranged that they would sit in the front row. And I think two of them still had their Sam Browns, which they'd kept and polished. And one of them at least had a shirt, I think, still, and a pair of shorts. But anyhow, I was the director of this pantomime, and I'd found a cigar from somewhere, a cheroot. I don't know how I'd found one. I suppose, I don't know, never mind. And I remember my job at the performance, of course, was just morale boosting. I mean, by this time, there was nothing else to do. And also organizing the timing. And I looked through I opened the curtain up to see how things were going. And our officers hadn't turned up yet, so I just waited. And finally, our officers turned up looking extremely smart, I must admit. Now, in the meanwhile, the NIPs had arrived and were sitting at the back. But I hadn't raised the curtain for them. I had waited for the British officers to sit down before the curtain went up. All those NIPs got up, walked 50 yards away with their backs turned, then walked back. Now that's the face, the real face game. That's professional face game. They thought they had lost face, and they thought they were winning it back again by getting up and walking back again. Ah, oh, it's a funny mentality, isn't it? What else about that? The performance was rather exciting. It was well done. But the prompter got Rigor got malaria in the middle of it, and was shaking with fever and wouldn't let go. I kept saying that somebody else could do it. No, it's my job. And there he was, quivering in the wings. And I remember that I learnt about public speaking there, because at the end, obviously, there was a shout for the director. And I had to come forth and thank everybody for what they'd done, and the audience for listening, and so on. And I suddenly realized that the way to, and of course it was great acclaim, big claps and cheers, and I realized the way to give a public speak is to tell people what they expect to hear. And you can't go wrong. I mean, you may have other messages you want to give, but if you want to make certain of popularity, tell people what they expect to hear, and then they feel fine. And I just told them what a good audience they were, and I thanked the NIP, and I thanked the people who'd organized the bonfires, and I thanked the stage, and I so on. And there were cheers. I wasn't saying anything at all. Yeah, so that
you
was
had,
the.
An interpreter for the Japanese.
No.
I wonder what they would have made of it.
Well, I imagine Nip Sargent, who knew the play pretty well. I think he spoke a little English. Otherwise, he didn't speak any Nip. And no, I think he probably explained it to them. It was at this camp that we had a very exciting surgical situation. A person was brought in with acute abdominal pain, and he was brought in about 10 o'clock at night, brought in on one of these engines from another camp. Nips had brought him to us. And the surgeon and I examined him, and it was pretty clear that he'd had a perforated ulcer. Well, for a perforated ulcer, you've got to go in. The longer you wait, the worse it is. You know, the stomach contents in the peritoneal cavity. Well, it was dark. We only had oil lamps. It's, you know, a little oil wick. And Philip said, I can't do this. I have to wait till the morning. I said, come on, you can do it. I'm sure you can. I'll give the anaesthetic. I'll organise the lights. You do it. And I talked him into it because I thought he was very good. I knew he was good. And sure enough, with a light, coconut oil light and a mirror, you can't shine a coconut oil light into the wound. But with a mirror, you could shine the light of the mirror into the wound. And we were very lucky. The perforation was right in on the front surface of the abdomen, of the stomach. There was no exploring to find out. The duodenum would have been awful. It wasn't at the back. It was right on the surface. So, you know, having made the abdomen, having gone in, there it was, sticking up at him. So he did a couple of stitches and went. It was easy. But we didn't know it was going to be easy, obviously. And he recovered, and that was a great success. And he was Australian, and he and Philip made contact. In fact, he came to Philip's funeral about 6 months ago. So that, and he used to send me Christmas cards.
Have you had an anaesthetic?
Yes, we did have an anaesthetic. It must have been chloroform. We must have had chloroform. Because I know later on I come to a camp and I had to have a little surgical operation and there was some chloroform. So, but I gave it, and I suppose it's either ether or chloroform. I just think chloroform.
About what time would this have been, that little camp, the happy camp?
How long?
Yes, you know, what year would this have been? And how near towards the end of the year?
I should think it's the sort of end of 44, that sort of thing, yes.
So the railway was built then and completed?
Oh, yes, yes. It was strange hearing these trains go by because they were English engines. And the noise of the hooters, or the, what do you call them, the... You know, a train makes a train. What's the noise of a train makes? No, a hooter. It's not a hooter. It's whistle.
Yes.
And of course, in the middle of the night, to hear this in the distance, you thought you were in Victoria Station. It was that same noise, you know. Very nostalgic indeed.
That was a big feat, wasn't it, the building of that railway, and you were involved with it for all of the time, it would seem.
Mm.
Yes. You were mentioning earlier that there was a book called The Railway of Death,
yes,
which you disapproved of that title.
I didn't approve the title, no.
It's
yes. Sort of like EastEnders a bit, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean,
we won't get up to EastEnders. I mean, it's your favourite programme. But, you know, really this alerted me to how you thought of the railway. One gets the feeling it was a railway of death, really.
Well, it was a case, yes. I mean, it is said that there was one death per sleeper. And they weren't, and we weren't the majority, remember. I told you about the Asians that were taken up there. They were the majority deaths. I can't, the numbers are available, but I think they're 3-4 times our numbers. Death, oh yes. Oh, it was certainly a railroad of death, but it's cheap. Publishers are bad at titles. They think they know. We wrote a book on salt recently. Salt, as you, I don't know if you're aware, salt, dietary salt, is very poisonous. It kills more people, I think, than tobacco. And we wrote a book about that, which was published by Cambridge University Press. And we wanted to call it Neptune's Poison Chalice, which we thought was a nice turn. And they called it Salt, Diet and Health. Now that gives you the imagination of publishers. They've none at all. I think they're wrong. Anyhow, sorry, you were...
Yes, you know, going back to the railway,
right.
And what a feat it was. Did you have any idea the parts you were on, what the whole thing consisted of? You know,
We knew it went to Rangoon, but we had a pretty good idea of what it meant to build it. But I can't see any pride in it, you mean, or what?
Just
in manufacture of it.
You know, the whole organisation of it and how it was built. on, you know, the labour of people yes. like yourself and the indigenous people as well. You know, were you given any idea of the scale that it was going to be, or did you think it was just the chunks that you were on?
No, we knew that there'd been three attempts before to build a railway. I think it's something like that. And I'm not certain that any of them had ever succeeded. And certainly all had foundered, and the jungle had taken it over. I mean, there had been attempts before. And of course, this is what happened to this one, eventually. It goes up to, I think, the Three Pagoda Pass, and it's mainly a sort of tourist attraction. But it doesn't go on into Burma, or at least I don't believe it does. Expensive to maintain, I should think, even that bit. But I can't say we had any feelings about the railway. It was a fait accompli. That was that, I mean, fact of life.
Yes, and this improvement after it was built, it would seem, from what you were saying, you know, things relaxed a lot.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Yes, and maintenance was pretty easy, really.
That was just on the track, wasn't it?
On the track, that's right, yes.
And when the logs rotted in the embankment.
I don't know quite what they were doing, in fact, these 100 men. They went off. As I say, it was very relaxed, very relaxed. But I must say it wasn't all that relaxed. Things are relative, aren't they? We had no quinine at this time. And I now discovered what happens if you have no quinine, no treatment for malaria. Most people recover. You have a death rate, but it's only 1 or 2%. They get big spleens, which is part of the immunological process. And they have recurrent attacks, and then gradually they get better. And this happens, of course, in endemic areas where there is malaria. The children get it. It kills quite a lot of children. The ones it doesn't kill are then immune, or have sort of chronic malaria, but don't have recurrent acute attacks. And I saw a lot of it there, saw that. But there was no great pressure to push them out, so they could have their rigors and quiet, and then carry on.
I think you said earlier, this was the result of the American success, is that
right? Yes, that's right.
In
yes,
the, it was the, in the war?
Yes, the better the Americans... Sank. The quinine is made in Java and in Indonesia, and there was plenty of quinine for us for a long time as prisoners of war. But when the Japanese started sinking the Japanese freighters, we had no quinine. I then went back to Chiang Kai, and at this time there were parties going off to Japan. I'm not certain there weren't parties going off to Japan before that, but I remember them more now, on this occasion. And I can't say anybody wanted to go, and one hoped one wouldn't be chosen. And of course, a lot of them were sunk again by the American Navy. Horrible. In holes, you know, trapped in holes. Several of the cast of the original plays and things that we put on, I was talking about earlier, were sent to Japan and sank. I remember one of them was the son of the people in pub owners in Chelsea. There's the pub next to the town hall, almost next to the town hall. Their son died there. Died in one of those boats. Yes, when I got back to the camp, clearly things were beginning to, as I say, we had been having news. I mentioned how we got news. We didn't have many news when I went up because we had no wireless with us, but of course it would come up with anybody if anybody was passing through. We got back to Chiang Kai, the Weber brothers were still going, and things were going badly for the Japanese, obviously, the Pacific, and of course the war in Europe. And there was a feeling that the war was closing, that we were going to win. And I think that's one reason that they were being taken to Japan. I don't remember much about that second visit to Chiang Kai, except that this was the time that one of the Nips was murdered by the prisoners of war. And what happened was the Weber brothers had the batteries for their wireless was threaded up a bamboo. The inside of a bamboo is split or is sectioned off, as you probably know, but you can destroy those sections, and then you have a hollow tube of some length. And what they used to do is put the batteries up one of these rafters made of bamboo, and then there'd be just a wire sticking out of the end. So their power supply was never touched. And one day some Nip came along, and he saw the wire, and he started playing with it. And they were very quick. They overpowered him, and I don't know what method they chose to kill him. And then they lowered him into the latrine, and so he disappeared. And he was a Korean, and we never heard anything about it. I mean, I think there were probably some desertions at that time. I'm not certain. I don't know. And they put his rifle in, and they put him in the rest of it. That's again a story which I heard. I didn't had nothing to do with that, but I think it's probably true. I mean, there was nothing else you could do. I mean, it would have been chaos if he'd gone on. Right, so now we come to leaving Chiang Kai. Now, I had been carrying about all my notes, mainly about Wernicke's encephalopathy, about which I spoke earlier at the beginning of this talk. And I had picked up another 8 cases in Tarkanun. I used to do postmortems in Tarkanun, and I picked up another 8 cases. And so I had a great wadge of papers, about 4 or 5 inches thick. And one tended to be searched on moves. But at that earlier on, they weren't looking for books, papers. I mentioned about libraries, didn't I? How everybody carried a book, and when you got to a camp, you made a library of it, and so on. So that Nips didn't mind about books and papers. But we began to realize that they were now searching not just offensive weapons. But they were also searching for any evidence that we might take with us of what had been going on. Papers, in fact. And I was detailed to go with a bunch of about, I think, 100 men, 150 men, and a sergeant, to go cross-country to another camp. I think we were gradually emptying Chiang Kai and going to this camp. And I realized that I had no hope of getting away passing this huge pile of papers, so I decided to bury them in one of the graves in the cemetery, Chiang Kai Cemetery. And I had 2 friends with me, and we chose a grave, and we dug down about 3 or 4 feet, so we were away from the corpse, and then covered it up again. And the papers I mentioned these RAF artificers. They made me from, I know, 4-gallon tins, 4-gallon containers. There were also some of those about. I don't know what had been in them originally. And he made me a 4-gallon container, which he soldered, and the papers were inside it. And as a sort of envoi, I put a cape around it. I don't know why. And we put it in, and we took bearings from where we were to various trees because we didn't know how long it would be before we ever got back. And it was decided that whoever was left in the camp, or who was nearest the camp, would go back and dig it up again from the three of us. And off I went. And we went by train all the way until we got to the river next to Bangkok. It goes through Bangkok. I don't know the name of it. Isn't it awful? Forgotten it. It's a big river, big wide river. And we had to wait there for quite a time, I think for about 4 or 5 hours. And there was food there, funnily enough, on the bank. I don't know how it happened. A good organization of some sort. And it was the most beautiful place. The Bangkok was the other side of the river, this huge river. Evening coming on, and it was grassy and sort of undulating with one or two trees, and it was relatively good weather, nice, coolish, warm, and somebody started singing. Yes, I seem to break down when I talk about music.
Yes, it must have been very poignant, you know, a scene like that.
And I don't know what we sang. I think some traditional song. But everybody sang. It was sort of, everybody was sitting where they had been sitting eating. And one voice started. And it all joined in. And but that was very moving. I think Jerusalem, I'm sure, came into it, you know. And there was an Irish voice, beautiful voice, who sang that song, Danny Boy. This lovely clear voice in this evening sun. Anyhow, that was finished and over, and the barges arrived to take us across the river, and we all piled in, and one man fell off and floated down river, was never seen again. I remember that very clearly because he turns up later, as you'll hear. And we went to a go-down. You know what a go-down is? It's a sort of building on a wharf. So it was a concrete wharf. And this four-walled with a thing with a roof and a concrete floor. It's for housing the goods when it comes off the ships. And this was a transit camp run by a Dutch medical officer, who's one of the heroes of my life. He had severe lymphoma and big glands, and he knew what he had, and he obviously knew he didn't have long to live, and he was marvelous. He ran the camp well, he dealt with the nips, he organized everything. He really was wonderful. I don't know what his name was, but he was one of these saints that turn up. And we stayed there, I don't know, not long, a week, a few days. I remember it was the hardest place I'd ever slept on. I never slept on concrete before. And the high watermark of my stay there, I never forget, the corpse of this fellow who'd fallen off was brought back to us by a boatman, by a Thai boatman, and tied on an iron ladder of the wharf. Well, I was the only officer, and I was the medical officer, and this fellow had to be buried. So somebody had to bring the corpse up from the water to the So that meant somebody had to go down the iron ladder, put a rope around him so he could be hauled up. Also, I was the best swimmer. So I went down the iron ladder and I got into the water, and he was very bloated by this time. And I had a rope, and I found myself embracing this corpse with my arms to put the rope around him. Finally got it around him, and I told the others. And they hauled him up, and I followed up the behind. And suddenly I heard a snap, and the rope had broken. And this bloated corpse was coming down the ladder. And I just had time to tuck my head in and hang on to the rungs. And he bounced off my head into the water. Then I had to quickly dive into the water very fast, because the stream, the river was running quite fast, and dive in after him, swim quickly, get hold of the rope, swim to the side, and then claw my way back to the ladder before we did it again with a better rope. And we finally got him up top. And I'll never forget the noise the poor fellow made. His skin was very tense with all the gases inside him. And as we pulled him along, it made the funny sort of reverberating noise, like a sort of solid balloon. And he stank. And he had to be buried. Well, there was a cemetery. There was always a cemetery in association with any camp, obviously. And there was a cemetery about 100 yards down the road. Well, again, I was the only officer. So I had to take the funeral. Well, I'd never taken a funeral in my life before, but in a pay book, there is at the back a funeral service, a very abridged one. So I got hold of one of these and I read it through. And then we put this fellow on a stretcher, put a cape over him, and we marched off. Well, I was upwind of him, thank God. But we got to the cemetery. And unfortunately, you could only dig about, the water level was only about a foot below the earth level. This was awful for burying somebody. A hole had been made, but it was water. Well, it would have been all right if somebody who just recently died. But this fellow had gone, it was used to the water, it floated. So we put him in, and he floated in his grave. So we had to put the earth and push him down. Anyhow, I ran. I then had to read out the service. And they're very sonorous phrases for the funeral service. Very, very sonorous. I began to enjoy myself reading these things. I suddenly said to myself, stop enjoying yourself. But they were such lovely words, you know. Well, finally, we dealt with that and went back.